Hello and welcome to Hey, Remember the 80s? I'm Joe.
And I'm Carrie.
Remember, we're not professional podcasters or music critics. We're just flashing too quick to see and talking about 80s music.
Yeah.
Welcome, Carrie.
Welcome to you, Joe.
Welcome to any new listeners or loyal listeners. We found some out in Fort Valley, Georgia, Madison, Tennessee, and Valby, Denmark. Welcome.
Hello to all those folks. Yes. Welcome, everyone. Please check out our Facebook at facebook.com/HRT80S. Find us on Blue Sky and reach out. Please. We love to hear from you. Joe, no tidbits this week. We are recording this one well in advance because you are going on vacation. So if something very huge in the world of 80s music has happened recently and we are not referencing it, that is why.
That's why, yeah. It's not that we don't care. Although I did just see a link this morning that Alison Moyet joined Gossip on stage and performed a cover of Situation.
Interesting. I love that for her.
Yeah, I think that's great. I never really see articles about her, you know, making appearances like that.
Oh, she was in the news a couple years. Well, it's probably like not last summer, but the summer before. Didn't she like headline Glastonbury or something like that?
Yeah, maybe she performed at Glastonbury. You're right. As soon as he said that, I thought there's something else. And I shouldn't even bring it up, but there was an article about someone who just sold the rights to their music.
Oh, boy. That's always happening.
And it was someone where I was like, got to tell Carrie about this, but I can't remember who it is. You'll see a headline at some point and be like, that's it.
Yeah. Joe and I send Marco Polos back and forth to each other. If you're not familiar with the app Marco Polo, it's like you record video messages and send them back and forth. Anyways, I was in the car driving and I listened to Joe's message and then started recording a response and literally couldn't remember what he had said 2 minutes ago that I wanted to talk about.
That just
happens all the time.
It's just getting old.
I know. It really
well,
is.
Well, I Googled, and I this isn't it, but, you know, Cyndi Lauper just sold the majority share of her music rights,
in the
last week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't
but
know that.
But that's not even who I was thinking of. It was a man. Oh. I don't know. It's not even really that important, because what does that even mean for us, the music fans? Nothing. It's just that these songs might pop up in a commercial, right?
I'm thinking about this. This is very off the cuff, but I'm just thinking, like, why would Cyndi Lauper do that? Why wouldn't she just leave the rights to her? I think she has a son.
She's getting the money now, you know?
It's kind of like betting on stock. It's probably worth more to cash in the value now than speculate what's going to happen with music rights in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the amount that she's getting in royalties is going down every year because of all these shenanigans that we talk about with streaming and all that.
And who knows what it'll be 10 years from now.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Who knows? So for no tidbits, we had a couple micro tidbits. And, you know, we might talk about these artists in this very episode.
Let's get to it.
This week's segment is a Billboard flashback. We're going back to the issue dated March 26, 1983. And you know how we do. You can go to worldradiohistory.com to follow along, because thank you to Marty Greeley of Long Beach, California. Every copy of Billboard from the 80s is scanned and you can see it in full, which is just amazing when you think about it.
Absolutely.
We're going to start on page 13 for a full page ad for an album by Simple Minds. The official title of the group's fifth studio album was New Gold Dream, 81, 82, 83, 84, but it is just called New Gold Dream in this ad. You know, I think that is just really unfair. Like, you're making us do this and type it out and write it and say it, but when you refer to it, you take all that nonsense off?
Yeah, I really was desperate to find out what this was about. Obviously, these are years, and maybe they're talking about, you know, a period of time in the band. But I was like, what is going on here? I couldn't find anything really that talked about specifically what those numbers are supposed to mean or why they were there. Answer me, Jim Kerr.
Well, you know what? Until we get that answer, and even if we do, I'm never going to refer to it in print or speaking with those numbers at the end.
Okay.
I'm taking seconds back of my life.
Good for you. Good for you.
Well, the band was going through a transition period during the recording of this album. After their last album, drummer Brian McGee had left the band, citing exhaustion. Three different drummers would play on New Gold Dream, with the third, Mel Gaynor, becoming a permanent member. Despite this, Jim Kerr had said that working on the album was wonderful because everything we tried worked. I would ask the drummers for a follow-up on that one. The album had been released the prior September, but hadn't made much of an impact in the U.S. at this point. The song Glittering Prize was the second single. Jim Kerr said it's about getting a glimpse of something and going out on a chase for it against all odds. It made it to number 16 in the UK, but it didn't make the Billboard charts. The only track from the album that did was Promised You a Miracle, which peaked at number 65 on the dance chart.
Isn't that surprising? Like, Promised You a Miracle gets a lot of play, I would say, on 80s stations. Like, not a lot, but you'll hear it. And that's strange for a single
song that only went to 65.
On the dance chart, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, you're very right. I think that, I don't know how to say it, like, even though they weren't popular in the U.S. until, you know, 85 with that breakthrough, I think people are like, we did them wrong.
Yeah,
you know, we should have been championing them all through the early 80s. And I think the song Glittering Prize is a great example of that, because the way it just comes on and starts, I feel like it just grabs your attention right from the beginning and it doesn't let go. And I never say this about songs because I don't notice, but I was like, this bass line is intense and I love it.
I think you're right about people re-evaluating them, and they definitely have become a band that is revered more than they were in the 80s, or at least more well-known and more talked about. I do like this song a lot. I really do. But it was funny, what struck me when I was listening to it this week was I had been researching Jimmy Iovine because he has, well, at this point, he had a birthday coming up and I was celebrating it on Charlie's. And I forgot that he worked on their later albums, you know, the big albums, Once Upon a Time, etc. And I was just thinking about this one in comparison to that and how it's a little bit more subdued. I would call Once Upon a Time and Alive and Kicking and those songs anthem rock. And this one is just kind of a little more sedate than that. It's still very good, but it's interesting to kind of see their evolution from this. They were still doing that kind of music, but I think they needed someone to take them to the next level. And I think Jimmy did that couple years later. But this is, yeah, definitely a good one. Definitely emblematic of their sound in general, and I just love Jim Kerr's voice.
I do too. Yeah. Can never say enough good things about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turning to the next page, 14, one of the most added R&B records at Billboard's reporting stations was She Talks to Me with Her Body by the Bar K's. And we talked about them several times in Just a Bit Outside. They had 33 hits on the R&B chart over the years, including 11 top 10 hits. She Talks to Me with Her Body would just miss out on that chart, peaking at number 13. She talks to me with her body. It's just what you want, I got it. So come on, boy, take me home. Guarantee you'll be turned on, even though it may take me all night long. It also made it 262 on the dance chart, but did not hit the Hot 100. After this album, two of the group's members left, and a year later, guitarist Marcus Price was murdered. Ooh. In all, the Bar K's have had about 30-plus members over the years, and a version of the group, which includes original member James Alexander, is still out there performing. The Bar K's is that band that started off as the backing band for Otis Redding, and then after some of the members passed away in that airplane crash that also killed Otis Redding, they went on, and I mean, they have such a long history. It's crazy to think about how long they have existed in music and how little you hear of them on pop stations.
Yeah, 100%. And even while you were saying that, I was thinking, what song do I know by them, right? I know the name. I've seen it a zillion times. Yeah. I have to know some of their songs, but I'm looking and I'm not seeing anything that's really that familiar to me. I guess this whole time I thought they also sang the song Oh Girl, and I see now that that's not them.
Yeah.
Do you know what song I'm talking about?
The original Oh Girl?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
The Shy Lights?
Is that who that is?
I think so.
Okay. Well, then in my mind, I was thinking they were kind of smooth soul. That kind of thing. And then when I heard she talks to me with her body, I was like, well, this is a rebranding. Because this is funky, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you think?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I didn't think it stood out against like some of the other dance music of the time. Like, this sounds a lot like what we were hearing from Zapp and, you know. Like,
the time is what I was thinking.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was thinking if it was a female singing and they flipped it, it would sound just like a Vanity 6 record.
Oh, yeah, that too.
But to your point about it sounding like things, I thought this would fit in with music from that time. And why weren't we hearing it more?
Yeah.
You know, it should have crossed over, is what I'm saying, to the pop chart.
I mean, it's a fun song. It's good. Everyone knows me at this point. Like, she talks to me with her body. I'm already like, ugh, no thanks.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's fine.
I did have a question for you because I'm not familiar with the subject matter of this song, but... She talks to me with her body. I assume that means like Ace Ventura. She like bends over and talks out of her butt.
You, my God.
That's what it means, right?
Absolutely. Okay, it must be what it means.
Yeah.
Did you look at the album cover for this?
Carrie, yes, I did look at the album art, and it has the woman in the red negligee.
Yes. Who is this? I was like, okay, if you're going to put a woman in a red negligee on your album, apropos of nothing, is she famous? What's going on? I was trying to find out. And I think she appears on other, well, I don't know if it's the same woman, but their next album too is just a woman in like a bodysuit. It's like, come on, what is this? Ugh, I don't like that. But anyways.
I see what you're talking about in the next album. Yeah. Go ahead and skip to page 24. There are a couple songs that debuted on the rock chart that we are going to talk about. First up, Reap the Wild Wind by Ultravox. It comes in at number 35. Ultravox formed in the early 70s, and their first single was featured in a soft porn film. That's how I know them.
You are on fire this morning.
They later signed a record deal, and their debut album was co-produced by superstars Steve Lillywhite and Brian Eno, but they had little commercial success, and after being dropped by their record label and having to self-finance a U.S. tour, lead singer John Fox left to go solo in 1979. The other members did stints in groups like Tube Way Army, but they came back together when Midge Ure agreed to join as their new lead singer. They signed a new record deal, and suddenly, several singles from their next album became hits, including Vienna, which made it to number 2 in the UK. Reap the Wild Wind was their first single from their 6th studio album. You take my hand, give me your friendship. I'll take my time, send you my story. It became their first single to hit the U.S. charts. It would go on to peak at number 27 on the rock chart and hit 71 on the Hot 100. Midge Ure would, of course, go on to have a solo career and was one of the driving forces behind Band Aid and Live Aid, although Bob Geldof always seems to get all the credit. Wonder if he prefers it that way. Good old Bob.
I don't know. It is really funny that you don't hear Midge Ure mentioned very much in connection with those things, because he was absolutely the co-founder.
Did you see Midge Ure recently? Or was he in tour? Or
He came to Summerfest a couple years ago, and I honestly can't remember if I went to see him or not. I don't think I did.
Must have been a good show.
Oh, I know what it was. I did see him, and then he performed right before Howard Jones, and then he came out and performed with Howard
That's
Jones,
right. Yes,
too.
Exactly. Yes, yeah.
Okay, so this song, you know what? I was really struck. I'm very familiar with this song. I've liked it for a long time, but listening to it this week, I was really struck by the opening synth line, and the synth line that continues through the song is
so... Hang on. Are you going to say it sounds like something?
No.
Okay, never mind. Then go ahead.
It sounds so popish. I can't believe that this song wasn't a bigger hit because it sounds exactly like something that should have crossed over, something like Iran by A Flock of Seagulls, or just so much of the stuff that was really hitting on the pop chart. And I'm wondering what it was about Ultravox that didn't click. I guess maybe they didn't have something like crazy haircuts, you know, to make them stand out.
Maybe they didn't have the push, you know, from their label for the US, although, you know, releasing a single in the US says something. So there had to be something going on, you know?
I think this one should have been big. And this is a song that if someone asked me, like, what's a deeper hit that would introduce me to more broad 80s music, I'd be like, this one. This is a good one.
And it took me a couple times to listen to figure out what it reminded me of. And it was giving me OMD, So In Love. It reminds me of that song.
Oh, yes. Oh, I agree. See, and that's another one. Yep, you're absolutely right. It's got that same exact flavor. And it's like, why? I want to know why.
Ultravox, I think I'm going to have to start listening to the deeper stuff, like even beyond this one and their UK hits. Like, what's the good one that I like? Dancing with Tears in My Eyes?
Yes.
Dancing that's a good one. But I want to hear it more.
Tears in My Eyes.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Also debuting on the rock chart is Art in America by Art in America, which is the highest debut of the week at number 23. Yes, you heard me right. Art in America can be added to the list of bands that performed songs with the same name as their group.
You know who else did that I just learned? You might have heard this on the R&B countdown.
No. Oh, what?
Cool and the Gang. Their first hit was a song called Cool and the Gang.
That's right.
I never knew. Let's make a playlist of all of the songs.
Okay. Let's start that up. Anybody have suggestions for us? Let us know. Well, according to Wikipedia, Art in America is the first known rock band featuring a pedal harp to appear on a major record label.
Say what?
I mean, who's tracking that? Yeah, is a pedal harp just a regular harp, what we know as a harp, or is it something different? I didn't look into that. Three siblings formed the band in 1980 and released their debut album in 83. It was produced by Eddie Offord, who was known for working with acts like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I included that bit because see if you can hear the similarities to those bands in this clip. The single never got any higher than 23 on the rock chart, and it didn't hit the Hot 100. They had one more rock hit from this album, but then never recorded a follow-up. Joe, let's start with the pedal harp. What did you think of that on this track?
I mean, if you asked me to pick it out of the lineup that I'm hearing, I don't think I could do it.
Well, I thought it was interesting because there's a whole, like, probably 15-second introduction, which is just a harp solo, but then it fades out and the song starts, and it's like, what was the point of that? I like harps, I think, and I could hear the harp throughout the rest of the song, I think, but I just was like, what's the deal? Show-offs, like, okay, we get it. You've got a harp. So that was kind of my opinion about it. Just integrate it. You don't have to have this weird, non-congruous solo at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I absolutely thought that it sounded like something Yes would have put out in the 70s.
That's so crazy. Before, because I didn't read this, right?
Okay.
I only heard the song a few times, and I'm like, this is 1983, and this is my thought process, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, this sounds like something Asia would have done in like the early, early 80s. And I was like, well, but they, you know, they came out like what, in 81?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, who was like that? I'm like, maybe Yes. I'm like, no, Yes didn't put anything out in the very early 80s. I'm like, anyway, they sound like a prog rock band from 1979.
Absolutely.
Is what I thought about this. And now to see that they had the Yes involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And not a bad thing. You know, I like Yes. I like Asia. But just something about hearing the more modern sounding songs in this playlist and then hearing this, I was like, this can't be.
Yeah, you're right. Overall, I think I liked the song, but it didn't seem of the same time as the other songs we were hearing. And whenever we talk about Yes, I always think about, we've probably told this story on the podcast before, but remember when we
did
used to play
Roundabout on Rock
Yes.
Band?
Yes.
And you would sing and I would play guitar and Yes. it was at least 9 minutes long, the version that was on Rock Band.
Yes. Roundabout by Yes, which who knows when it's from, sometime in the 70s, was on Rock Band.
I can't believe we're still friends after that. Now, Carrie, Art in America, I assume they're talking about Ace Ventura.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. Great. Page 27 has the MTV ads and rotation column. Some of the videos in heavy rotation, which is 3 to 4 plays a day, are Come On Eileen, Rio, and Jeopardy by Greg Kinband. I'm thinking they played songs way more than 4 times a day.
That's funny because I had the same exact thought. 3 to 4 times a day, more like 3 to 4 times every two hours.
2 hours. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Well, that's what they're saying. Mm-hmm. I see it there in black and white. Included in the light rotation, which means 1 to 2 plays a day, is Love Me Again by John Hall Band. John Hall actually has an interesting story. He started playing the piano at age 4 and quit college to pursue music professionally. He founded the band Orleans in the early 70s, and during his tenure with that group, they had 2 top 10 singles, Dance With Me and Still the One. Disagreements over musical direction led Hall to leave for a solo career, and he also became an activist at that time, becoming involved in the anti-nuclear power movement. The John Hall Band had 3 singles hit the Billboard charts from 81 to 83, and Love Me Again was the last of those. The song made it to number 41 on the rock chart and number 64 on the Hot 100. Carrie, what are your thoughts on this song?
I really like it. There are parts of it that I don't like the bridge, but every time the chorus comes around and he goes, I want you to love me. It's so good. I get this stuck in my head all the time. And when I was listening to it this week, it finally kind of clicked for me where it's one of those songs I always hear and love. And now I'm like, okay, that is Love Me Again by the John Hall Band. And now I know to include it on playlists and I love it.
Yeah. And you said you had a bad memory. You don't.
Figure out. I thought you meant I had a bad memory about this song.
Oh, no. You forget things from 3 minutes ago, but you've got it locked in that the song Yes. is by John Hall Band.
Have we just talked about this recently? I feel like I've said this to a bunch of different people, but have you seen that commercial with Jennifer Aniston? Did I just tell the story?
What commercial?
Okay. The commercial with Jennifer Aniston that is out recently, I don't even know what it's for. I think it's for DoorDash or Uber Eats or something. But the whole
premise, it is Uber Eats. Yeah, yes. Yeah, I've seen it.
The whole premise is that you only have room for certain information. And so the older information gets replaced. And this woman is getting a haircut and it's the Rachel haircut. And Jennifer Aniston goes, oh, I love your haircut. And the woman's like, yeah, it's yours. And Jennifer's like, no, what are you talking about? The whole thing is like, she doesn't remember the Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, that's how I feel. It's like all of this 80s music stuff has replaced everything else in my brain. I can remember who's saying love me again, but I can't remember what we talked about 2 minutes ago.
That's life.
Yeah.
I didn't even say about the song that I really enjoy it too. And not to sound like a hypocrite after what I just said about art in America, this just gives me like late 70s, very early 80s, like power pop and good harmonies. And I don't know. To me, that was nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a difference. I mean, I think prog rock didn't really have a place in the 80s, but definitely power pop is a good way to describe it. And I think that definitely continued to be very popular throughout the decade. Yeah.
While Hall continued to write songs for other artists and reunited with Orleans a couple times over the years, but in the late 80s, he started a new career as a politician. He served as a county official on a school board and then ran for the U.S. Congress and was elected in 2006. He served as a rep for New York's 19th congressional district for 4 years, and these days he lives in Nashville and still performs occasionally with Orleans. Good for him.
Thought it was really interesting reading his Wikipedia about how, you know, he kind of got involved in the anti-nuclear power movement and that spurred him into larger politics and activism. And it was really cool. I mean, that's the way people should be inspired to run for office. I don't think that's really the case for a lot of people these days. I don't know what their motivations are, but it certainly doesn't seem like interest in helping people.
I bet he was friends with Jackson Browne.
He was. That was mentioned. There was a specific group that was formed, which I'm forgetting the name of, the group behind the No Nukes concert. And John Hall and Jackson Browne were two of the artists that formed that group. Yay.
Nice.
Well, here's an interesting aside. Page 31 is a full page ad for the first video games conference, co-sponsored by Billboard and the Video Marketing Game Letter. Get ready for exciting panels like Teledelivery, Threat or Savior, about the alternate ways of providing consumers with games, like downloading games via cable TV or telephone lines.
Oh my God. And it says millions of gamers may be able to have their fun without ever buying a cartridge or a computer game disc.
I know.
They got that right.
It is so funny to see stuff like this. That's why I love going through these old billboards, because there's something like that where it's just like, oh my gosh, you would not even believe. I wish I could get in a time machine and go back to 1983 and describe to these people at this conference what actually happens. Yeah,
I would have definitely gone. It was only $175.
There you go.
Do you get to stay at the hotel or you, that's separate? Anyway. We're going to page 41 because Peter Stein of Australia has taken out a small ad which screams, Joe Cocker, have I got a song for you? And Peter has included his address and phone number. We got to find out if Joe ever got in touch. This is insane.
Peter Stein of Australia, if you're out there, please let us know.
Let's call the number.
It's an international phone call. Are you going to make that?
I want to know how much this ad cost.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's not a quarter, but maybe like an eighth. It's not insubstantial.
Yeah. Huh. Good for him.
Yep. Back to the music. The Talent in Action column on page 42 includes a review by Carrie Darlene. Great name.
That's your new nickname.
Of a concert recently held at the Roxy in L.A., Carrie says Georgia has produced some of the best neurotic pop around and cites R.E.M. and the B-52s as celebrated artists of that genre, but calls the Brains from Atlanta one of the best but least acclaimed. Keyboardist and vocalist Tom Gray apparently only came out from behind his equipment to glare gleefully at the audience. According to Carrie, the band performed a stunning version of Dream Life, which featured the complex interplay of drummer Mauro Magellan and bassist Keith Christopher.
Cousin Keith.
Here is a clip of the album version of Dream Life. Lightning striking keeps missing me. Flashing too quick to see. I can't hear the heart rate. Brains only released two albums and one EP before breaking up shortly after this review was published. Their 1980 self-titled debut album was produced by Steve Lillywhite, that name again, and it has the original version of Money Changes Everything, which was written by Gray and would later be covered by Cyndi Lauper. A couple of the Brains members later played in the Georgia Satellites. Because I was such a big fan of REM, I was more cognizant of bands from Athens or Georgia generally. I mean, REM would often give shout outs to bands, you know, in interviews and stuff like that. And I would always try to learn more about them. And the Brains was one of those, but I just remember knowing that they were a band from Atlanta, but I never knew any of their songs or couldn't name any of them. You know, these two, Dream Life and then the original version of Money Changes Everything, they're good. They are very good. I don't know if they spur me to want to listen to more by them because I feel like other groups have this area covered, but I enjoyed them. I enjoyed learning about them and I enjoyed these songs.
I would say these two did make me want to listen to more of their music. I was really intrigued. I also liked the album artwork for, what was it called, Electronic Eden. It had to be the first album cover made with Microsoft Paint.
Yes.
Did you see it on the YouTube clip?
I did see it. I'm pulling it up again.
Well, if you put it on YouTube in the outline, then they must not be on Apple Music.
Yeah, that's correct. I think maybe one of their albums is, but not this one.
I will see if I can find a vinyl or something. Yeah, I liked both songs. Money Changes Everything I'd heard before because, I mean, obviously because I love the Cyndi Lauper version a lot, but the original is so great. I love it. I love hearing it and then listening to see what Cyndi did to make it different because she really kind of did make it her own.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we talked about this before, but then she wrote a song with Tom Gray for True Colors.
Oh, I didn't remember that. That's great.
They wrote a song called The Far Away Nearby, and that's a good album cut from there.
Is that the one that Amy Mann sings backing vocals on?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, interesting.
So now there's two reasons to seek it out.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got some quick hits from the rest of the issue. And of course, I cannot pass up the chance to mention the picture on page 48 of Erlene, Louise, and Barbara Mandrell sharing a laugh during the taping of a Louise Mandrell special, which was scheduled to air in the spring. I'm sorry, a Louise special?
Yeah.
This is news to me.
Yes.
Louise's IMDb is woefully incomplete. It has her credited for only one episode of Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters, but it does list a special in 1982 called Good News for You in 82, which is Roy Rogers, Dale Evans, and Louise Mandrell join the Oral Roberts family for a country hoedown. Oh, gosh. Carrie, why would you tell me this information?
I don't know. Louise.
I didn't need to know that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I have put a chink in Louise Mandrell's armor for you.
And listen to this fluff piece. Barbara Mandrell is asking her booking agency to schedule her spring tour through Florida so she can attend training camp with the Dodgers. Well, Barbara apparently believes that a few sessions batting with the Dodgers will teach her how to beat Conway Twitty's softball team this season. We aren't sure ourselves exactly what a few sessions batting with Barbara Mandrell is likely to teach the Dodgers, but it ought to be interesting if it all comes about. Literally a softball article, right?
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Jeez. I was shocked to go on IMDb and see that, you know, Louise was only credited for one episode of the Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters.
She's in so many. Like, she's in all of them, you
know? I gotta do a deep dive and figure out what was going on with that show because I have so many memories of it. And I'm like, where was I seeing this? How long was it on, et cetera? So I'll have to do that in the future.
Okay. And on page 65 in Photo News, there's a pretty weird picture of Jules Shear at the Boston airport. The caption notes that his debut album, produced by Todd Rundgren, would be released that spring. We have talked about Jules Shear before and songs he wrote that were later covered by the Bengals and Cyndi Lauper. He also dated Amy Mann, and he married Pal Shazar of the band Slow Children. The single from his debut album was Whispering Your Name, and here's a clip. It did not chart, but in 1994, Alison Moyet's cover version made it to number 18 in the UK. She keeps on whispering your name like she's just waiting. What did you think, Carrie?
I loved this song. And yes. I was trying to figure out how I knew it. Because it seemed very familiar to me.
Did it remind you of any other songs at all?
Oh, God. No, you're putting me on the spot. No.
I know. I thought I should have told you, but I was going to say, let's say it at the same time.
What is it? What does it remind you of?
The pre-chorus. I might have to find a clip to play it, but it sounds to me just like Crying.
Crying by Roy Orbison? Oh, interesting. Oh.
I hate doing that.
It sounds familiar. It's interesting because in addition to this Alison Moyet cover, it was also covered by someone named Ignatius Jones. And I was like, do I know that version? Do we play that on the attic? But we don't. I for sure have heard the song somewhere, either in a movie or somehow.
Yeah, or in the song Crying.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. But anywho, I love it. A Jules Shears version is amazing. It's so good. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind Alison Moyet's cover, but definitely the original is the best.
You know what? I listened to both a few times and I thought I liked Alison Moyet's version better. And then I just realized it maybe has better vocals, but there's more interesting stuff happening musically in Jules's version.
Absolutely. I mean, you're surely right about that. Alison Moyet's definitely a better vocalist than Jules Shear, but I think there's something very raw and exciting about his voice that fits the song.
Agree.
Okay, I have to mention that on page 44, there is a small blurb about Milwaukee's Summerfest setting its headliners for that year's fest. If you attended Summerfest between June 30th and July 10th, 1983, you may have seen the Beach Boys, Melissa Manchester, Donna Summer, Cool and the Gang, or Engelbert Humperdinck. That really gives you a flavor, though, of the variety of headliners that you'll get at Summerfest. I mean, you know, they do a pretty good job of having something for everyone. There's also on page 68, the continuation of an interesting column from page 3, which talks about the alleged pressure MTV received to play Michael Jackson's video for Billie Jean. Record execs denied that on the record, but one quoted anonymously said, there were definitely threats made, including one to pull all other videos from the CBS label. So this story continues to be an urban legend, but I was actually shocked that it was in Billboard, like talked about in Billboard in print. So very interesting.
Finally, on page 43, the highest debut on the dance chart for the week, all the way up at number 41, is You Can't Hide by David Joseph. The dance tracks column on the same page talks about how the song got marvelous remix help from Larry Levan in its U.S. release. Brian Chin says it's now far weightier, pushing harder and harder right up to the last percussion break. The song would push all the way up to number 2 on the dance chart and would make it to number 72 R&B. David would hit the dance chart only once more.
I thought this was a really interesting one. I'd never heard it before, I don't think, but made it to number 2 on the dance chart, and I really like it. It's good, and I like this remix for sure by Larry Levan.
I didn't know what was happening.
Okay.
I still don't know.
Like, in what respect?
I saw the artwork. I heard the song. I'm like, this has got to be some kind of tidbit in the show where this is something from like the late 90s or early 2000s.
Oh, interesting.
I was like, how is this going to fit in? So now I'm even more confused.
David Joseph and Larry Levan were way ahead of their time, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Okay. All right. Well, let me give it a few more listens and I'll report back later.
I liked it. I thought it was very good. It's definitely a good add to, like, Matt Baylor, add this one to your next DJ set. Maybe
he's
he already has it.
Yeah.
This is definitely one you could pull out and impress people with where they'd be like, what's that? All right. That's it, Joe. That was a good one. I don't research these before I pick which issue to do. This one I just picked merely because it was actually dated March 26th, the day that this drops. But it was a really good one. I enjoyed hearing all those. And we haven't done this for a while, but I will definitely say that Whispering Your Name was the star of this week's playlist.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let me think. Let me go back. I think I'm going to give my star to Glittering Prize.
All right.
But it was a very tough competition this week, I would say. Some pretty good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and there really wasn't a dud. I mean, there was ones that were better than others, but there certainly wasn't one that I wanted to skip every time, which usually happens.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So next week, Joe, we are going to be doing the British Top 30, which is a record store find for me. A radio show from like 1985 or maybe 1987.
Did I know this? I don't remember you getting this.
I definitely showed it to you when I first got it, but it's been probably 3 or 4 months since
Was
then.
It at, like a, you found it at a record store or you got it online? Oh,
no, I found it at a record
good
store.
For you.
So, yeah.
Great.
So we'll dig into that. I think it'll be pretty fun and get ready for it.
I'm excited. Now take us out of here.
Okay. Hey, folks, please be kind to yourself, to others, to the world. And hey, there's always goofy stuff going on, but we got to do our best to just keep on keeping on and enjoy every sandwich.
Yum, yum. Thanks for listening.
Bye.